Welcome to the Herd Quitter Podcast. I'm your host, Jared Lumen. On this show, we talk to farmers and ranchers who aren't afraid to think for themselves and do things a little bit differently. We hope these guests will challenge you to look at your farms and ranches in a new way and result in a more profitable and enjoyable business for you and your family. Hello and welcome back to the Herd Quitter Podcast. I am really excited for this conversation that I'm having today. It's one that I've already recorded. I'm actually recording this intro in here after the fact. But it's with Drew Bruner, who's a rancher from northern Missouri. And it's one of those cool stories that are pretty rare of somebody in a relatively recent time building a ranch from scratch. He started in the 2000s, I forget which year now, late 2000s, early 2010s, somewhere in there, and has grown his operation pretty sizable to operating a pretty sizable stocker cattle enterprise and sheep enterprise. And so it's a really cool conversation. We dive into a lot of the things that he did to make that happen, including the way he started out that is not how he's operating currently. Talk about his thoughts on land ownership and whatnot as well. So definitely going to be a really good conversation. A couple things I wanted to share before that. In the past, I've mentioned that we had some cattle for sale. We do have around 20, 21 maybe cows still available for sale at this point. If that's something that you are interested in, you know, you can reach out to me at herdquitterpodcast@gmail.com. These are our low input Red Angus herd developed in a pretty low input and tough environment kind of these are the type of cows that are going to thrive and without all the crutches and the supplements. So if that's something you're interested in and think might fit your enterprise or your operation, feel free to reach out. Again, you can reach out to me at herdquitterpodcast@gmail.com. But I also want to thank our sponsor for today, Barn to Door. Barn to Door is a solution that is built for farmers like myself. And my wife and I, we use them to grow and manage our direct marketing business. If you're looking to access more customers, Barn to Door can help your farm build brand awareness on web, social, and email to access a wider audience. In fact, my wife and I have been working with Barn to Door now for over 3 years and have seen our registered customer base increase 5 times, which has helped provide more consistent cash flow for our family. You can go to www.barntodoor.com/herdquitter, where you can learn a little bit more about our success. And if you choose to sign up, you'll get access to a free academy session as well. That's a $99 value. Again, the website is www.barntodoor.com/herdquitter. And I'll have that link in the show notes. Thanks so much, guys. And we are going to dive into our conversation with Drew Bruner. But just to get us started, maybe for those who are listening, tell me a little bit about yourself. Where are you at? What do you do? And then we'll dive into the story of how you came to be doing what you're doing.
Well, my name's Drew Bruner. I live in Northeast Missouri. We're about 13, 14 miles south of Iowa. And if I wanted to go to Illinois, it'd probably take me, 50, 55 minutes. So Sure. Pretty close to the Iowa border. Really good cattle country down here, really good pasture country. We get about 40 inches of rainfall annually. That's about on average. Just beautiful green hills, which unfortunately a lot of those green hills are farmed now. And a lot of the hay ground is no longer hay ground. But that's where I'm at. It's great cattle country, great sheep country. And that's what I do. I do farm full time. My wife's a nurse practitioner. We run stocker cattle in the summer, usually turn out about into April, 1st of May. We'll run them until, well, of course, last year was different because of the drought. But, I'd like to run them till September or the 1st of October. I used to try to run them a little longer, but we got into the sheep business and it's to stockpile the amount of forage that, to have a low maintenance sheep flock all winter, you kind of need to get those cattle out a little bit earlier so that, you're not feeding hay all winter to the sheep. So I'd like to never feed them hay, but this week I'm going to have to with all this snow and 15 mm-hmm. below zero, I'll probably have to help them out a little bit. But I used to have cows. I sold them out a few years ago and just went 100% stocker cattle, and I was really nervous when I sold the cows, but I wouldn't have one back for anything. So,
wow. Well, I am going to get a whole bunch more into your actual production when
yeah.
we get there. But one of the things that really intrigued me about your story was that you didn't grow up, or maybe you did, but the farm you're running anyway now is not a farm you inherited or you're taking over from family or anything like that.
No.
It's a pretty cool and unique story that I think a lot of folks dream or aspire of doing someday. And looking at you now on the call, I didn't know who you were. You look relatively young, so what you've accomplished in your time is pretty impressive. But yeah, I guess talk about where you started, and you weren't in production ag.
I was born in Lancaster, which is just a small town north of here, probably 7-8 miles away. My dad was a county sheriff for 20 years. I grew up in town. Always liked farming, agriculture. I mean, as a kid, had all the farm toys, the big sandbox, my grandparents had like 40 acres and like a dozen cows. And of course, I loved going over there and just fooling around. But it was nothing, major, full-time, anything like that. My dad grew up on a farm out west of Queen City, but his parents died in the 60s when he was in Vietnam. And he just wasn't able to hold on to the farm, and it got sold. And he tried to farm in like the 70s or 80s, but that didn't work. And so he'd been involved in it, but nothing, any scale, to make a living at.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I just always liked farming. I had a couple friends growing up, and they, they were on farms. I just really liked hanging out with them and helping them and everything. And but I never had, it was never a reality of mine to do it for a living. So I graduated high school in 2003. I'm 38. Went to Northwest Missouri State in Maryville and went for wildlife ecology. I thought I'd be a wildlife biologist, but I changed that in the first semester because I just could not handle all the botany and zoology. And not that in hindsight, I wasn't smart enough. I just had other priorities whenever I was there, and doing botany wasn't one of them. So we, I got out of college, because back then it was, you just have to have that piece of paper, that's what everybody always said. Just get a degree. You just got to have a piece
Absolutely.
Of paper.
Yeah, that's all the way it was in my family too. Yeah.
I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I've always loved history. So I got a degree in history, got out. I had no idea what I'm going to do with that. I couldn't even be a teacher because I didn't get a teaching degree. I thought maybe I'll go to law school. By the time I got out, I was so burnt out with college.
Yeah.
I just, started working construction, which is what I'd always done on the side. Work for carpenters. And, actually got a job with John Deere in Ottumwa, which is north of here, about an hour, and as in their plant, and then became a shipping coordinator there. And used that piece of paper, like they said, which had nothing to do with my degree, but it was a good job. And while I was there, I had a friend that had 80 acres that he wasn't doing anything with. And he'd bought it when we were younger, and I rented it and bought 27 cows and put out there just because it's something I'd always wanted to do. And while I was working at John Deere, I was helping some of my friends part-time on their farm, just, riding horses and help put up hay. And just, I was having fun, But here's this opportunity. So I bought these cows and put them on his farm and I had no machinery, nothing. Bought an old truck to put a bale spike on so I could, I bought my hay, obviously. And I was still doing construction on the side, even though I worked at John Deere, and we were roofing houses. I had a crew, my stepbrother and some of his buddies were helping me. And we roofed a house at this old couple, and they had 400 acres, and they told me they were wanting to sell it. Of course, I was like, there's no way. I mean, I can swing this, and they wanted me a tour of the farm, and they did. And that winter, I found out that the 80 acres that I leased was going to get sold. And I was going to sell my cows. So I couldn't find any other place to rent. And I called this couple and I said, you still want to sell that farm? And they said, yeah. And they kind of shot me a price. And I thought, well, there's no way I can do that. So I heard about this bank, this bank in Kirksville, and this banker, and I went to him and said, hey, I know there's this beginning farmer loan, blah, blah, blah. And now this banker has made some loans that's got him in some trouble.
Okay.
But he sat there in about 5 minutes of pecking at a keyboard. Chef said, yeah, that'll work. I can get you the money. And I said, hey, well, I'm going to need to buy, like 100 more cows. He said, that's fine. Yeah. Well, so long story short, I bought the farm on, we closed on it on April 1st, 2011. And that's when I bought, I had 27 head of cows and a 2001 pickup. And I bought 400 acres at 25 wow. years old.
Wow.
And I know that sounds crazy, but that was right before land really got high.
Sure.
I mean, I'm not going to say it wasn't luck, but you know, what's held me together in all these years is the amount of equity I had for buying that farm when I did, you know, because a bank can look on paper and say, wow, you know, you've got all this equity now. Not that it, you know, isn't still hard to pay for, but you know, I was able to buy that farm. That banker took a chance on me, and that's just how it initially happened.
So did you, when you talked about the equity, were you buying it with equity, or did you say over time you've appreciated now and now you have
over
equity?
Time I have appreciated. Okay. No,
so
I didn't have
get a
anything.
Steal on it.
No, I mean, I you know, yeah, I just had to, and it wasn't a steal. I mean, at the time it was, I mean, at the time a pasture farm like this, you could have got anywhere from $1,700 to probably $2,000 an acre for it. I bought it for $1,600. I mean, that's what I paid for it.
Sure.
The old couple, they're good people. They wanted to help me out. They were offered more money for it, and they just said, "Hey, we want to sell it to you." And they treated me great. But you know, when I first bought the farm, I wasn't farming like I am now. So you know, here's the train of thought of anyone young that buys cat around here anyway. Anyone that buys any cattle, anything like that. Well, now I've got this farm and I've got these cattle. Now I got to feed them. So the first thing I did was I got to go to town and I've got to start buying tractors and hay balers and rakes and everything. And so that's what I started doing. I have some friends that farm a lot, and they farmed part of my farm on the shares. We actually, and it's sad to look back on. It's a beautiful 400 acre rolling grass farm. And we farmed about 200 acres of it because at the time, you know, I'll never forget my loan officer saying, you know, $10 beans sure makes cash flow look good. You know, and this, you know, this was in 2010, whenever I was doing the planning. And and there was like no, everyone just said, oh, you have to farm it. You have to farm it. Mm-hmm. There's no way you're going to pay for that farm if you don't farm it. Yeah. So that's what we did. And I was fortunate to rent some ground close to my farm. And I, you know, all my cows would go out to pasture in the summer to rented ground. And I would farm my farm. I would hay my farm, what we didn't. And then I would bring them back home in the fall and run them all over the whole thing.
Sure.
And I was renting hay ground and, you know, just keeping all my equity burn up, but never really making, you know, a lot of money. And that's what, you know, I think that's one of the, I'm not going to say mistakes, but that's one of the mindsets that I had and that I think a lot of young people have is everyone, when they start farming, there's just this general, I guess you'd say, outlook that, well, you're just going to be broke till you're 70, you know, you know, that's just the way it is. You get started farming and you're not worth anything till one day you wake up and you're 65 years old and boom, you know, you get to retire and you're finally worth something. And that's just the mindset I had. I didn't really care if I made money, you know, as long as I was doing what I wanted to do. And I was still working at John Deere for a while until I just couldn't do it anymore. But my farm kind of started to change in, I guess I would say, I'd owned it for a couple years. And like I said, my cows all went to pasture in the spring on rented ground. And all these lots around my house just kind of grew up. So I thought, boy, and I've always loved sale barns. I love going to barns and buying cattle. And I thought, maybe I should buy some calves and start kind of running in these lots and bucket feeding them. And and my loan officer said, yeah, let's do that. So I went and did that. And of course that was back right before it got high and I hit a lick and I was addicted. I bought those calves in the spring of 2013. I sold them at Labor Day, spring of 13, sold them in the fall of 13 and just hit a lick on them. And I was just hooked. Yeah. And I thought, well, I got to do more of this, you know? So I immediately went right back out that fall, bought probably 150 more heifers. Put some electric fence up around my house out here, out in some of the pasture, bucket fed them all winter, sold them that spring, hit another lick. And I was like, this is me. This is what I'm going to do. And that's how my buying feeders started. Got lucky, you know, right off the bat to do that. And it just seemed to work out at first. And just kind of grew it from there. And then I started, you know, looking around, and some of the rougher pasture that, you know, I had said that, you know, I would send my cows away that I would hay. I look at them, I thought, man, you know, instead of haying that 15 acre hill, why don't we fence it off and run even more cattle on it? But long story short, you know, over the next year or so, I turned 70 acres of my farm into basically a backgrounding yard. Mm-hmm. I had five pens. Again, equity had on paper had allowed me to borrow more and more money, and I was up to feeding 800 head of calves a year. Wow. Here at the house. I went out and bought a mixer wagon and two front wheel assist tractor. And here's another, I'm not going to say problem, but at the time I was doing this, it was very easy to borrow money.
Yeah.
You know, just like, and I didn't even realize how easy it was until I remember one day I always thought, like, you know, I was feeding cattle with a two-wheel drive tractor. One day I was like, man, I'd like to just have a front wheel assist tractor. And yeah, I just drove to a dealership and bought one, you know. Yeah. And I didn't realize it was, you know, so this is easy. And the guys were still farming some of my farm, and I'd started chopping silage. And but I owned all the cattle. I never custom fed at all. And it got to a point, it's not that it didn't make any money, but it got to a point to where it just wore me slick. I mean, you know, every day.
You were still working this whole time, or were you farming full time now?
I quit John Deere in, I think when that was, probably it was 2013.
Okay.
Spring of 13 is when I left up there. And we just went to the farm. Yeah. So,
okay, so you were farming. Yeah.
But that was, you know, I was single. I met my wife in the spring of 13, and, you know, I didn't require much for me to live. And, you know, the farm was going to the farm, and I didn't have to support a family or anything like that. So, I was able to do that. But, where was I at? But, you know, feeding all these cattle, and it just, we went in and fenced all these pens off, and probably by 2020, everything had started to wash terrible. Because, you know, that was kind of my mentality. You know, I'd have a pen and I'd have 80 head of calves in it. I thought, boy, what if I just put 20 more in, or 20 more in, you know? And I was buying all my own cattle, bought a lot of like cutting bulls, you know, cattle that you could upgrade, steers, bulls. And I had a kid helping me part time, and we were always processing cattle and sorting cattle. And it was, you know, at the time I loved it, but, you know, the older I got, I was literally watching my farm wash down. You know, and I'm surprised no one ever called me in on it. Like, I had some of my steepest hills were just, I mean, gullies and rocks everywhere and bare dirt. And, you know, you'd wake up after a 5-inch rain. And I'll talk about this in a little bit. Whenever we ended up tearing out some of my pasture pens and converting it all back to grass, you know, I had 6-barb fence that in 2 years only had 4 barbs showing. And I even went and bought a small dozer just to maintain everything. And it was just, I mean, it's not that I was going broke, but it just seemed like there was no end to, you know, everything that went out or everything that came in went right back out. You know, I was spending $250,000 a year on feed and fuel, and, you know, the fuel bill was outrageous, and there was always something broke, and it just, I was just sick of it.
Yeah.
And I kind of started researching, like, you know, rotational grazing, intensive grazing, whatever you want to call it. I started doing some research on this because what it always got me about it was the fact that you could do more with less. You know, I could still run, I could have grass, but I could still run more cattle than what you conventionally could.
Mm-hmm.
But I never pulled the trigger on it. I always was just, you know, researching it and thought, because, you know, I hadn't owned that farm very long, and just, you know, to do a 180 would just be, you know, all of a sudden, you know, it was a pretty big undertaking. So I kept feeding cattle, and in about the spring of, I have a neighbor that I could tell. He'd bought a farm by me, you know, a few years ago, and I could, you know, he was working a job somewhere, and I needed help. And I kind of went to him and said, hey, you know, is there any way, would you be interested in working for me part-time? And the guy said, well, you know, I'm working construction, I'm making pretty good money, but I really want to stay on the farm. And he had bought a farm that had been farmed to death, mm-hmm. and he had converted it into rotational grazing, put up all of the high tensile fence and everything like that. And I was kind of watching him do that. And I knew he wanted to be a home more, and he kind of got started by doing some custom grazing. And he'd asked me, he said, hey, you know, finally he got back to me. He said, yeah, I'd be interested in working for you. But he said, I need someone to graze some cattle for in the summer.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, you know, there's another $400,000 I'm going to have to borrow, but
yeah,
if I get a hired hand out of it, you know, whatever. Yeah. I'll run some cattle on you. You know, I like to buy cattle. Yeah. I'll put some on. And that first spring is what changed my whole perception on.
If you're like Drew and like to buy cattle, then here it is, your invitation to join Wally Olson's online cattle marketing school February 27th through the 29th. Wally is a seasoned expert in sell-by marketing and will guide you through the intricacies of calculating the difference between a good deal and a bad one. If you're ready to dive into the world of sell-by marketing, you don't want to miss this course. You can sign up today by visiting www.ranching.fyi/Wally Olson. Whether you're a seasoned rancher or just starting out, Wally's expertise will empower you with the knowledge to make informed decisions while also letting you gain insights on how to better market your cattle. Don't miss out. To register, visit www.ranching.fyi/Wally Olson and select the February 27th through the 29th course. In 3 days, you'll learn how to take your passion to profit. Enroll today at www.ranching.fyi/Wally Olson. Now back to my conversation with Drew.
What I'm doing. You know, he helped me in the feedlot, and we turned those cattle out about the 1st of May. And he kept saying, you got to come and look at him. You got to come and look at him. And I said, no, I want to wait for him to get a little size to him, you know, and I don't want to just come out there every week and look at him. So it was about the 1st or 2nd week in June. And I said, okay. So I went over to his farm, got on a side by side, and we rolled out there to the pasture. And I mean, it was one of those days. It was just gorgeous. You know, it was probably 80 degrees outside and the grass was just waving and the sun was high. We pull up there to this poly wire and here's 400 steers just standing there. And he grabs that reel and reels it back. And those things just, you know, at the snap of your finger, they went through, they stuck their heads down and they started eating that grass. Not one of them bawling, you know, no mud, no anything. And from that moment, I said, this is what I want to do. And I said, Shelton, we're going to do this with my farm. Yeah. And that was just, I just had a moment. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
In the pasture. And I said, this is what it's all about. And from that moment on, I just looked at everything differently, you know, and it was so, you know, here I had, you know, I was at my farm at the time. I don't know how many cattle we had here, 800-900 head. And, you know, I had 400 over there and we literally fed them in about 20 minutes with nothing but a side by side and a strand of poly wire. And I was like, this is the bare bones. This is raw agriculture right here. You know,
yeah.
It's the sun, it's the grass, and it's your brain and the livestock. And that's it.
Yeah.
And from that moment on, I changed my whole farm.
Yeah.
And went down a whole different route. And I know I kind of got off. We were talking about how I was able to buy that farm. Kind of got off on a different tangent, but yeah, I mean, but that's what. So over the next, I guess you'd say 2 years, I took my little dozer that I had bought to maintain my pens, took all the pens out, started seeding my entire farm back down, ran rural water all over all 400 acres of it, put in all high tensile fence. and just completely changed everything that we were doing here.
Yeah.
So.
Well, it's just funny. I was literally just having this conversation with somebody yesterday, like almost a very similar conversation to what you're talking about there, where someone was saying is like, well, I want to be in the cattle business. And they were looking at building a barn and like building a feedlot and stuff. And I was like, so, okay, let's say two people. And the conversation I was having with them was almost like two people each have 200 acre farm they come up with and stuff. And one guy wants to get into the feeding business and he's got to build a barn. He's got to buy a loader. He's got to buy a tractor, a mixer, a manure spreader, a corn stalk chopper to blow in their, stalks and everything like that. And, where the guy who's doing the grazing business, I walked through the expenses with him and it's like, yeah, you might have $10,000 in fence, a couple thousand bucks in poly wire and stuff and step in posts. You might want an ATV. And if you get snow in the winter, even though there's not cattle there, I might want a loader tractor around or something to push some
Yeah.
snow. I mean,
Oh,
you're all
sure.
in for like 40 grand versus I think with that scenario of building a barn was 1.25 million plus the land and operating expenses and everything annually. It's wildly different.
I think, though, something that a lot of people forget about is that not every, and I know this is going to kind of sound crazy to say, not everyone farms to make money. Some people just love it. They just love the lifestyle. And if they can, kind of like I said earlier, there's just this, perception that, you just don't make money till you're old, especially if you start young. You just don't, you just live on the edge and have good years and have bad years. And I mean, I know plenty of people that aren't doing it to make money. They're doing it because they want to farm and they want to, jump in that tractor and feed wagon every day and feed the like that, and that's just where, there's just a difference. But I got to a point where I said, no, I'm not going to do that. Where I'm going to be profitable, or I'm not, or I just as well, I've got a college degree. I just will go to town, get a good job somewhere,
Well, I think there's a lot of people that want to farm, and I even look at like which of those two options looks like a more realistic or reasonable way to try and get started. I mean, even if you get the land for free as a $50,000 investment into fence and stuff and then custom graze cattle, or is the $1.25 million you need to build a building and stock? I mean, what's more reasonable? What can the average person get into if they just want to find a way to farm? It's like, I don't know how you made it work. It's pretty remarkable how you got done what you got done.
Thank God I didn't do some of the other ideas I had. I mean, at one point I was going to build a humongous silage pit to put, the put, and that was going to cost, $150,000. That would cost more now. It's going to be a huge one. I wanted to build a big building to put old cows in and just have them out. And I had this grand plan to, the calves would go through creek gates and go out and graze in the pasture all summer, and I would just feed the cows every day. And I look back on that and I'm like, if you would have done that and built all that, like you're stuck with it. I have a buddy that built a hog barn and he just hates it. Well, what do you do with it?
That's and at least in the cattle barn, you can still be an independent producer. A hog barn, if I've heard a lot of a hog producers losing their contracts lately, that's a pretty stressful position to be in. And it's not like you can just go out and profitably buy hogs and fill a barn and make a living that way anymore.
But and I back to kind of my story there. I kind of I did sell my cows. I got to a point. I got down to one rented farm, and it was kind of questionable whether I was going to keep it because the people that owned it, they were going to sell it, I thought. And I did end up selling my cows. I don't remember what year that was. I think it was 2019. I sold all my cows. But that was a great. I'm not. I have nothing against. We gotta have people with cows. There's no doubt about it. It just wasn't for me. It sure wasn't for me. And I just never made any money on my cows. Now I didn't manage them like I should have, because it all goes back to proper management. I didn't. My overhead was too high. I brought them home in the winter. I fed them silage all winter, and no, they never had a chance to make me any money. But I was so glad whenever they left. I sold them in April of 19, I think, when they left, and that was a great decision.
And when was the decision to switch to the all putting your farm all in grass and everything?
That was in the spring of 21 is whenever I put those cattle out on the custom to be custom grazed. That's the spring that I thought about starting to transition it. And we started, me and Sheldon, the guy that helped me, we started it, I think, that July. Mm-hmm. Now, I did this without any Equip funds. I just borrowed the money and did it myself. I would strongly encourage someone to use Equip funds. It's a lot cheaper. But the time frame that the government had and I had were two different time frames. I had made my mind up that I was sick of feeding all these cattle and I wanted to make it, you know. And then if you know how Equip works, you know, you sign up for it and you don't know if you get it or not, you know, and there's a process. And yeah. And even though I had a buddy that used to work there and he said, you're doing everything that the government is wanting you to do. You're taking highly erodible ground, you're seeding it down, you're doing rotational grazing. He's like, you are a shoo-in. Well, guess what? My first contract, didn't get it.
Really?
You know, they said, and I shouldn't say this, but I'm guessing that money went to build terraces on highly erodible ground that shouldn't be farmed anyway.
Yeah. Or a manure pit for a big dairy or something. That's where a lot of it goes around.
Exactly. So I got passed up and I said, you know, I since switched banks to a different bank. My first bank, like I said, my banker got into trouble, and I switched to a different bank, which is they're incredible. That's another thing. You know, if someone's wanting to get started farming, you've got to have a good bank. You've got to have someone that understands you, trusts you. Mm-hmm. And I've never gave them a reason not to. You know, I've always, you know, held up my end of the deal, and they have gone along with me like the whole way. And you know, that's a very important asset. Mm-hmm. And so I just borrowed the money and started doing it. And I started, you know, buying my water line and buying everything. And me and Sheldon got a map of my farm and laid out what we're going to do. And then the NRCS office calls me and says, oh, well, you're approved for Equip. And I said, oh, well, great. Well, I started doing it. And I said, oh, you already started doing it? Well, you're rejected.
Yep.
Okay. I guess I'll just do it on my own. Yeah. So I didn't even really get mad about it. It was just one of those deals.
Yeah,
it's frustrating, but at the same time, you know, I can do it my way, and I don't have to answer to them at all.
I've heard a number of stories of Equip nightmares working through their whole process and their standards and whatnot. So yeah, if you're able to do it yourself and it's not going to put you in a world of hurt financially or something, it might be best to just go without it, but it definitely helps. I've also heard some pretty awesome success stories.
And like, especially here lately, because everything's got so high, you know, grass seed is just outrageously high. You know, water line, you know, I think the PVC, I ran 2-inch PVC all over my whole farm.
Wow.
I think it was like $1.60 a foot or something. Or no. Yeah. It was really high. Like it was.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm wrong. I shouldn't say that.
No, that sounds right. I think our one inch stuff was like 70 cents a foot.
It was crazy. Like I borrowed $80,000 to do the whole thing.
Yeah.
And we did a lot of it ourselves, you know, like all my, my fiberglass posts, we made them. I got a semi load of this
sucker
fiberglass rod from like the oil field or something. Yeah. We cut it down, used a drill press, did all the labor myself. You know, we built all the fence, I did have someone come with a trencher and trench the lines in, but we stabbed all the pipe. I mean, built, did everything. But kind of back to when we started doing that. So here was the plan. I'm sure everyone thought that I was crazy because we started doing this right when commodity prices were getting high, you know, and I had, you know, all the, you know, 200 acres of not great row crop ground, but decent laying. And we started to build the soil back in the feedlot and to build the soil back on my crop ground. We started planting a mixture of annuals. We would do wheat in the fall and we would do sedan grass in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a drill, so I drilled it myself. The first year I did a weird mixture. I got into researching, you know, kind of regenerative agriculture, and everyone says, you know, you got to have mixed species. So, I mean, I had like 20 freaking things that I planted, you know, sedan grass and buckwheat, sun hemp, turnips. And I will say I only did that for 1 year, and then I went to straight sedan grass. Because the sedan grass seemed like, yes, everything comes, But the sedan grass seems to choke out the other, you know. Mm-hmm. So your sun hemp plant, you look at a picture of a sun hemp plant, it's really tall. Well, you put it next to a sedan grass plant, and it's about a foot tall. You know?
That's the same way we saw it. It was kind of almost frustrating. I mean, they always talk about diversity and how important it is, and we plant diversity. And it was one of two things. Either A, you plant sorghum in a way that actually maximizes your production. You can get more production and you don't get any growth on anything else. Or if you want growth on something else, you have to give up enough sorghum that your total biomass production goes down significantly. And our limiting or our kind of resource concern was always maximum feed production. So we've kind of gone to a pretty much straight sorghum mixture as well.
And I wasn't, you know, I first kind of, like I said, I kind of started researching regenerative agriculture. So I didn't fertilize it hard because I was like, oh, that's a no-no, you know, oh, I just, you know, I don't want to put very much on there. Well, you know, there's a time and a place to do certain things. And it's like, you know, obviously I've researched all the, you know, the talking heads in the industry, and Jim Gary said something one time, I won't forget. It's like, well, you know, you can say don't spray, you can say don't use fertilizer, but you know, all of us have different time frames, and sometimes you want to get from point A to point B. And so I should have fertilized a little bit harder at first. We do now. And my goal, obviously, one day is to never buy fertilizer again. But sure. I'm just trying to build, you know, I've got to, you know, have a lot there to put back. So I started with my steepest ground first, with, you know, sedan grass and everything, grazed it. And it was, the good thing about it was, like, it just, after they grazed it and trampled it, it just made this just mat on the ground that just held the erosion. It was, it was great. It was, and I sold all my feed bunks. I sold like, I sold almost $30,000 worth of just feed bunks.
Wow.
Now this, another good part about it was kind of during COVID. So everything had escalated in price. So I was selling stuff for what I had paid for it, you know.
Phenomenal.
And that's awesome. Yeah, I went out and sold $30,000 worth of feed bunks, and we, you know, I used that dozer and we took all the fence out, and I kept a couple pins just to kind of, you know, ease into it just a little bit. But yeah, so we started the annuals and got a couple pins down, and then eventually I think I got rid of all of my feedlot cattle in 2022. I think August of 2022 was, no, I think it was August of 21. That was the, I'm sorry. I it was somewhere in there.
No worries. Yeah.
Finally got rid of all the feedlot cattle, everything we were planting annuals on. And when I first went into this, I didn't really have a plan to go all grass. I love the annuals deal because of how much forage that sedan grass puts out.
Yeah.
Well, the older I've got, I hate sitting in a tractor all day. I hate it. I would rather go build fence than drill sedan grass.
Yeah.
I'm serious. So I made my mind up. It's like, no, we're going all grass because there's always something. There's always a bearing going out of this drill, and you know this. So, I just kind of started the process of seeding the farm down to, like, I guess you'd call just grass, you know, mixed grass, fescue, clover, timothy, orchard grass. And I'm still not there yet. I still have probably 90 acres of annuals that I'm going to break up over the next 2 years before I go to grass, just because it's so nice, you know, at times to just peel all your cattle off and go through those annuals, you know. And give your grass a, you know, a rest for a little bit. So that's kind of what we started doing here at this farm, and put a water system in. I'm really glad I didn't go with the tire tanks like I was going to. We ended up doing like an underground like deal with like a tile that comes up out of the ground with a lid on it, and I built these portable tanks. That, you know, there's a, basically my PVC, you know, goes straight up, and then there's basically, it looks like a hydraulic coupler, like a female end of a hydraulic coupler. Out of my tank is a heavy duty garden hose with the male end, and just shoot, you know, I didn't have to build, you know, cause each, you know, if you had built those tires, pour that concrete and put all the guts and all those, it probably, you know, you're looking at $1,000 a piece. And then, oh, by the way, what if 8 months later you decide, oh, I didn't want to put that there, you know, what do you do?
Yeah.
So And I'm glad we did that. And I've had to add some fence since we've got going, because I had some paddocks, some pastures that were just too big. And I just do not like stretching, 3/4 of a mile of polywire, So I kind of shortened them up a little bit. And then, doing all stalker cattle is what I do on it. And, but I used to kind of try to run it year round, and I've got where now we're just going, doing it in the summer.
So you still own all your own stalkers. You never did custom grazing yourself, but you bring them only in the summer. And what did your numbers do going from making feed and feeding it in the lot to going all grass? Can you still run those same 800 that you were doing before?
I'm running around 700, okay. But I did buy another farm. Okay. I'll get to that. And I could run more, but the reason why I'm not is because I added sheep. And I guess I haven't got that part
yet.
And I want to stockpile enough forage for my sheep in the winter to where I don't have to feed them, or I would run more stalker cattle, or I would run them longer. So in Shelton, the guy's helped me, he's doing some grazing and everything like that. And he got into the sheep business. Actually, he was custom running sheep for somebody. And this was in, 2022. And I kind of fell into the, I'm glad I bought the sheep, but that was the all time high. That was when people were going sheep. The sheep deal was crazy.
Yeah.
And so, he said, we bought these sheep in, and they lambed their hair sheep, and you don't have to shear them, and you don't have to, worm them. And they just lay down in the pasture and have babies. And then we sold them in September, and they brought $300 a head, and there's nothing to it. And I thought, well, I've got to get in on that deal, But the problem is, it's really hard to get into the sheep business, because it's not like cattle where you can just go out and just buy like a herd of really, really nice bred ewes. If you can, it's hard. It's hard to do. Mm-hmm. People either just buy first time ewe lambs and breed them just because it's so difficult to find them. Well, I'd called around and I got a name of a buyer in Southern Missouri, and I bought an entire, like in January of 22, I bought 250 Yos from a guy.
Yeah.
Now, everything from a first timer to probably old. And it was, I had a wreck with him. He had never got the babies off. So they lambed all winter long. They didn't start in first of May. They started they got here.
Yeah. He didn't let you know that?
He didn't let me know that. Well, he did. I did call the guy later on. I was like, man, I'm just having a heck of a time with these sheep. He's like, yeah, I never did get the bucks off of them.
Thanks for the heads up.
Yeah. So I did have kind of a wreck. I had a lot of sheep that just weren't good sheep. I mean, they would just drop a baby and walk the other direction. And I have a buddy that's really into the sheep deal, and I've asked him a lot. And the advice he said is cull. That's what you have to do. So I got through it, and that late spring, we gathered all my sheep up, and every single thing with a dry bag, I pulled off. Mm-hmm. If it didn't raise a baby, I got rid of it.
Yeah.
And that's how I started. And I was like, if I'm going to have a good sheep herd, that's what you're going to have to do.
Yeah.
So that was the kind of the what I started doing. And then sheep prices just went to crap, and
I guess I knew I heard the jump, the real high. I didn't know if they went bad or just back to kind of a normal.
So my lambs brought, I think when I sold my lambs that fall, the first fall after I'd, had them, or I think they brought around $100 a head, which honestly isn't that bad if you have a really good sheep herd and no more than you put in them. Isn't terrible. I mean, that's not a terrible price.
Yeah.
But it was a third of what I thought. There'll never be another bad day in the sheep business.
Yeah.
But I got into the sheep deal kind of to like complement my cattle, I guess, and to be able to get two incomes off of one farm. I think a lot of people, you'll read magazine articles or something about a farmer, and they'll say, we're a diversified operation, and we have corn, soybeans, and cattle. Like, mm-hmm. Well, I guess, but not really, because your crop acres are just crops, and your cattle acres are just cattle. You know, you're not getting two incomes off one piece of ground.
There's no stack, enterprise stacking.
Yes, that's what I wanted to do was like you said, stack the enterprises. And I, so, you know, I wasn't going to give up on the sheep deal and had a really good lambing year last year, you know, got my rams in like I was supposed to, you know, in December and lambed in May and had a good year. Prices came up a little bit. I think my lambs brought like $144 last year, which is really good.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I sold them off the yoke in September. And they're just mutts. I mean, they're a Dorper, St. Croix, Katahdin cross, just everything.
Perfect,
though. I kind of like the Katahdin Dorper cross rams. You know, I'm not real, you know, I bought a couple, what you'd call high dollar ram. They're probably, you know, $600, but the rest of them I just kind of raised or got off of a buddy. And I'm growing the sheep herd. My goal is, so we had a wind turbine farm or a wind turbine project come through my neck of the woods probably 3 or 4 years ago. And I ended up getting a turbine on my farm, and we got one on the farm that we bought last year, 2 years ago. I'm not a proponent of wind farms, but I got them. I mean, yeah, I signed up. All my neighbors did. That's a whole other subject for another day. Anyway, regardless, I've got two of them. So I made a goal of mine to have enough sheep to where my sheep and my turbines would make my farm payment.
Okay.
So I don't have to rely on the cattle to make my money.
Those are all.
So that's what I'm in the process of doing right now is keeping enough replacement ewes every year to do that.
Yeah. So. Well, I was just thinking when you talked about the sheep, it seems like just a perfect balance. I think one of the biggest challenges that I've heard for wintering cows down in your environment is mud, and I mean, it's never freezes solid. And I don't know, maybe I'm wrong about this, but the sheep, I imagine they're a lot lighter. They're not probably making as much of a mess in the winters, and the cattle that you have leave in the fall. So you get cattle integration in, but they're not there in the tough season, in the feeding season, or in the mud season, and the sheep balance a lot perfectly. And that taking those stockers off early enough to get enough stockpile for your sheep, it's just a beautiful system in theory. Now,
And I mean, there's a lot of misconceptions on sheep, I feel like, because I'm like kind of self-taught, you know. I just bought them. I just winged it and bought some one day and finally got them paid for, which is that's another important thing. If you're going to make my own sheep, they got to be paid for, you know.
Okay.
You don't need to have a mortgage on breeding stock. I understand, you know, you got to start somewhere, and that's a whole other tangent I don't want to go in, you know. You know, some of these older, you know, kind of talking head type people will say, you know, oh, we don't borrow any money, but we, you know, we live in a day and age now where it's not feasible. Like, I love Gordon Hazard. Like, his book is, I've read it like three times. Like, Gordon Hazard was like, after I read his book, I said, that's what I want to do.
Yes.
But he has such an old school mentality that would not work in 2024. You know, you're going to have to borrow some money. And, but I worked really hard to get these sheep paid off. And the misconceptions out there about sheep, I guess the sheep deal to me, it's kind of all what you want to get out of it. You talk to people and you say, you know, people say, oh, you know what, you know, you get to, you know, I got, for instance, I bought a brush hog for my skid loader off a guy that owns a dairy farm. And I started just kind of, you know, visiting with him, and I said, oh, you know, you must like to work, you own a dairy, you know, and you know, I mean, milk twice a day and everything. He's like, well, you've got sheep. He goes, you think I like to work? I said, there's no work to, I don't do any, I mean, they just eat grass, and I move them once a week, you know. I don't move my sheep every day like the cattle. I move once a week. But the thing with the sheep is, like, whenever they're lambing, and this is, I read a really good article on that, there's that online database that's got the grazing articles on
pasture.
I really like people that will talk about stuff that everyone else won't talk about, which is, like, for instance, on the sheep. You know, a lot of the people who's kind of the talking heads that are kind of big up in the industry that's in sheep, they act like, well, you just don't, you have no, you know, like when they're lambing or whatever, you have no contact with them. They just do it on their own. You stay away from them, you know, Mother Nature, just let it do its thing. And that's fine if you want to do that. But I'm going to tell you, like, you know, you're going to have some orphan lambs and you're going to have, you know, it's what do you want to do? Do you want bottle lambs? You know, because it's just as, you know, if you have, you know, we have a lot of sheep and, you know, you're going to have orphan lambs out there in the pasture. You're going to have mommies have babies and get up and move them and then, you know, sit down and maybe, you know, have a twin that she didn't know was coming and forget about the other one. Yeah. Or another one is, you know, a big storm rolls through that night. Like if you're, you know, if it's the 10th of May and you are just spitting lambs out left and right and a big old spring storm comes in, you will have orphan lambs the next day. Yeah. You know, are you going to, you know, are you going to make bottle lambs out of them? You know, are you going to, drive through them? You know, I know a guy that has a lot of sheep and he told me, when his sheep are lambing for that month, he only goes in the pasture to check the dog feeder. That's all he does.
Yeah.
Whatever happens, happens, you know, Mother Nature takes its course, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I do a little bit of both. I can't just let an orphan starve because it's just me. I'm not saying, you know, if you want to just let the, you know, Mother Nature take its course, there's not, I mean, that's your call. I can't do that. I just kind of stay at a distance with a pair of binoculars and just kind of watch. And if I can see a obvious trouble, then I'll bring them to the house and we'll feed them so we can get rid of them. Mm-hmm. You'll see a yo that's been pushing for a long time and, you know, you help her out. And to me, that's just the animal husbandry in me that I can't get away from, you know, but you can't play God too. I mean, because you get that many sheep and that many lambs running around the pasture and you start saying, well, you know, this little lamb's kind of by itself, but maybe it isn't. Is it that one's? Well, which one is it? Should I put a mark on? You know, you can't do that, you know, because you are going to mess things up. So you have to find that fine balance of
interventions.
And that's the thing about sheep, I guess. I've kind of got off the cattle, which I want to get back to the cattle, but that's the thing about having that many sheep is I feel like you can't manage them properly, you know. Okay. If you have a cow herd, you can look at number 44's ear tag and just be like, oh, you know, old number 44, it's, you know, her time to go, or her, you know, her calf isn't very good. You get several hundred sheep with all those lambs and they're hard to manage, you know.
Yeah.
You just kind of got to do the best you can.
And I would say almost that's maybe even a good thing, because it's some of the overmanagement is where a lot of the costs and the head, I don't know, I kind of like your idea of just running them, and anything with a dry bag in the fall goes. That's simplicity in its finest. I mean, let the animals that make it thrive and go. Great.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, absolutely.
You can overmanage, I guess, is what I'm saying too.
You can overmanage, yeah. But that's the nice thing about sheep is, I guess, if something slips by you for a year or a couple years, it's not like that cow that's costing all that money to keep.
Yes.
You're not out much, you know, if something slips by you. And I never worm a sheep. I move them once a week to a different pasture. They are all hot wire broke, obviously.
How many strands?
I run three where the sheep are.
Okay.
I run some of my ponds, I put two because I don't care if you're underneath it, you know. But you've got to put three for the. I haven't bought any sheep since I started my deal, so I haven't had to like train any to hot wire or anything like that. But but that's my sheep deal. That's kind of how I got started in sheep. And just like I said, that at first I was just going to have a couple hundred just to kind of have around, and now they've kind of taken over, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that makes sense. How many are you running now then?
I've got almost 400.
Sure.
My goal is to get to a little over 500, and the reason why is because what I'd said earlier, if I run that many sheep, it'll make my land payment.
Yeah.
So it should be like, you know, if I want to average, you know, 1.3 lambs per yo at $125 a lamb, that's where we're at. And yeah. I'll be there next year.
And you're able to, for the most part, run those year round with the exception of blizzard and random stuff. Like you can graze stockpiled forage and they'll get through winter just fine.
Yes. Oh yeah.
Wow. Absolutely. That's
And I put out some hay at times. You know, if I've got an area of my farm, I'm not necessarily saying I do bale grazing, but like if I've got a ditch or something that might need some hay in it, you know, I'll stick some bales out there. And you can tell that the sheep really, you know, have, you know, worked on it a little bit. You know, it's just something to kind of supplement them. I will say this. I probably should have waited to get sheep until I had more established grass because like that wheat, you know, of course, once they eat it down, it's gone. You know, it's not coming back till the spring. And when you have a lot of annuals, you're relying on annuals, but the annuals are gone. There's just not as much, you know, I don't live in Oklahoma. So, you know, our wheat in the fall is, you know, probably going to be 3-4 inches tall. It's not going to be 8 inches tall. So, you know, they're going to eat it down, you know, pretty quickly. So I wish I would have waited till I had more established grass, but,
Cause they can't handle sorghum, right? That'd be so much
leaves. I run mine in, mine run in my sorghum patch. Yeah.
When, how tall are you grazing the sorghum at that point?
Well, they're in there after the cattle.
Oh, sure. Okay.
So
they brought it down to their level then.
Yeah, they brought exactly. Yeah. They run in there after the cattle. Yeah.
Okay.
So I don't, you wouldn't be able to find them if you didn't.
No. Well, yeah. Okay, cool. That makes sense. Well, that's like I said, in theory, this model sounds fantastic. Obviously, I mean, there's a reason people aren't in sheep, and that's because a lot of people aren't in sheep is the challenges that come with them and stuff. But the economics of them look so much better than cows for sure. I'd be curious how the economics look per acre or per animal unit, I guess, in comparison to stockers and stuff. But that it seems like a really good balance of enterprises that you have there. But hopefully that continues. I guess you said you wanted to talk more about the cattle and stuff too. I'm curious go ahead.
Yeah, no, our stalker cattle, I used to, you know, post feedlot when I had the feedlot, we bought every week.
Yeah.
A couple years ago, my cattle we bought in the fall, I wintered them and then turned them out in the spring. That's kind of the old school mentality, and there's nothing wrong with that. It costs a lot to winter cattle, you know, and you can build some ground doing it. You know, you could do, you know, you could buy some stalkers and like do some bale grazing, or, you know, you're going to have to supplement them in the wintertime with a little bit of grain because, you know, it's, you know, 10 below zero outside, you know, they need energy. I did that. It's pretty expensive. And then last year, when I bought my cattle, I bought them in February. And, you know, so I still ran them over the winter. Now, the kind of the old school mentality of why you do that is so guys get what they call compensatory gain. You know, they think the older, agier, you know, greener, tailed out type cattle when they go to grass just explode. And they're right about that. But with 8% interest and $100 a bale, hey, what's that compensatory gain worth, you know?
Yeah.
So, and I've kind of, I'm not a master at any of this stuff, but, you know, I've kind of changed the way I do stuff. You know, at first I was buying, you know, 5-weight steers in the fall. Last year, I kind of thought, well, I'm going to have a kind of a regenerative type mindset to these stalker cattle. I'm going to buy really lightweight cattle because, you know, it's all about profit per head. You know, they cost less, they generate less interest, you can run more of them. Going forward, I'm going to buy heavier cattle. Those lightweight cattle, it just takes them a long time to get where you want them to be. You might just maintain them for a long period of time as opposed to them, you know, from day one gaining weight. And so this year, for instance, my plan is I make a little grazing plan. It's not probably worth the paper it's written on, but I try to make a little grazing plan of this is approximately what day I want to turn out. This is what I want to buy, when I want to buy them, how we're going to process them. So I'll buy cattle this year. The plan is to turn out about the 1st of May because I still have 100 acres of wheat. I'm going to turn out on that wheat, and I'll start there. We'll buy them probably a week before I go to turn them out, have them on hay for 24 hours, process them. And then I've made a series of like training pastures to kind of kick them into that. I might put a little hay in there, but hopefully by then the grass is good and they don't, you know, it's nice, nice. We've had such late springs, but I just hope we have a normal year this year. And anyway, just to, you know, kind of when they're in their starter pen for the first 24 hours, I run a poly wire along like the sides where they're going to be walking. Mm-hmm. Just to get them familiar with it, touch their nose to it, you know, might tie some cans to it.
Yeah.
In these training pastures, I try to zigzag around the waters, you know, to make, and you're going to have some go through it. It's just the way it is, but just kind of make it to where they have to walk around stuff. And so that way, when we turn them out, they're familiar with the poly wire, obviously. And, but I don't, I mean, I went from buying hundreds of bales of hay a year. This year I bought 50 bales. I said, you know what? I'm just going to force myself to only, you know, I'm going to force myself to try this model. That's why I only bought 50 bales of hay, you know?
Sure.
And I've got some old hay. I've got some really old hay that I'm going to get, you know, set out for my sheep if, you know, conditions get really bad. But this 50 hay is for the cattle. And so I'm going to, and I, hopefully I have hay left over because, you know, that's how a buddy of mine does it. You know, he gets them in, just has them in for a couple of days, training wire, kicks them right to grass. The least amount of overhead possible, you know. And so I buy predominantly heifers. This year, you're going to buy some 5-weight heifers, turn them out, process them, you know, give them their shots. I do implant them. So I know someone's head probably just exploded driving down the road listening to that.
They'll get over it.
I do implant them. I, as far as growth, I tell you what, I'm a firm believer in implants. Cattle just stretch out and they just, you know, as far as, and you gotta keep in mind, you know, we're not talking about, you know, South Pole cattle. We're talking about Angus, Charolais cross, Simmental cross cattle, you know, different, that, you know, that aren't just going to just explode on straight grass. I do supplement my cattle every day. I have to. I know there's guys in other areas, you know, in the Dakotas, Montana, might not have to supplement at all. But here in Northern Missouri, we have to, you know, fescue, you know, predominantly. And like I said, you know, I've got that Sedan grass and that helps out a lot. But a little grain seems to go a long way. You know what I mean?
Well, and I don't know if you've listened to the podcast I did with Chad Peterson a couple weeks ago.
Yes.
He talked about his supplementation program and how much money that makes him just in additional carrying capacity and gain and everything like that. I think it's, you know, a lot of people probably hesitate at the idea of supplementation, and in a cow calf herd, I struggle with it significantly, especially in the winter when she's not even lactating and feeding a calf or anything. But in a model like yours, where you're getting paid on the pound, and if you're, it's a fairly simple equation. If the cost of the supplement is less than the gain, the increase in value, it's a, it can be.
You don't have to go crazy, you know. I've got a 3/4 ton pickup with a feeder on the back. Mm-hmm. They call them cake feeders, even though you don't feed them. I don't know why they call them that. But, and I've kind of got a little system of how I know, you know, and I've got a bulk bin. I know how much weight goes in there and how many, you know, X amount. And I just go out every day and make, you know, every morning at daylights, whenever I feed them, and I just make piles on the ground. I used to do strips, but they waste so much when you try to make a windrow. They just walk down it. You just got to make piles. You know, I start off the summer with basically straight corn almost, start off the spring with basically straight corn. And then about July, I'll switch it up and add some, you know, protein to it, gluten. And plus, if anything ever happens, you can get those cows. I mean, that's another thing about feeding them. They'll go any, you know, they'll follow you anywhere. They'll follow me to town if I want to, you know.
Yeah.
So I do supplement. Just where we live, you just have to, you know. And I understand there's cattle you don't have to supplement, you know. To give you some props, I have a buddy that bought some Faro genetics off of a guy to fatten out on grass. And mm-hmm. I have a scale at my house that we weigh cattle on. And he brought them over, and they were grass only, and they were fat as ticks. I mean, they look like they had been, they've been weaned forever, and they look like they come out of like a feed, you know, off their mom. I've been running to a creep feeder all day, and they've been grass only. And, you know, the cattle that we're buying out of these sale barns, you know, you just, they won't do that.
So, no. Yeah.
Got to supplement them.
That's fair. Yeah. Okay. So you talked about how you do your supplementation. Now you're only keeping them during the summer months. Is there a reason why? I mean, you just don't want to be in the feeding business all winter, and you don't want to burn through that stockpiled forage, essentially.
No,
So.
I don't. I had an old order buyer tell me one. Now, you got to remember, the last couple of years, this cattle deal has just been crazy. And all of the old adages have gone out the window. I fed cattle there for years, back out of them all winter for nothing. You buy them in the fall, the health is not very good on the cattle in the fall. And you feed them all winter, and there's probably 3 weeks in that winter that they don't gain any weight, and you burn a lot of fuel. And I just decided if it's not economical, I'm not going to do it. And people, even have buddies that they'll laugh at me like I'm lazy just because I don't want to run cattle. And seriously, like they'll be like, "Oh, you,
I'm
and this
proud of being
is,
lazy in the cattle business. Yeah.
what are you going to do all winter?" Well, I'll figure that out,
Yeah.
My wife was really concerned with what I was going to do all winter, and I said, "Well, when I run out of things to do, we'll discuss it. But until then, I've been staying, pretty busy."
Yeah.
It just seemed like back in the day, those cattle markets, you would buy them in the fall, and you would back. Well, you got to think about it this way: you get those heavy yearlings, February, March, April; those cattle kill in August. And August historically is the lowest month on the fat cattle board. So, the highest is April. Well, when do guys buy those cattle to finish in April? They buy them in September, October, and November. So that's, and I'm not saying that's going to hold true every year, but I bet 9 out of 10 years it does. And so that's why I decided to not have any cattle around in the winter.
Sure.
I'm not saying every now and then I don't get a wild hare. And like last year, I bought like 40 head and just kept them here at the house and just bucket fed them, like some steers, bulls, something like that. Just background them for 60 days and sold them. And the market came up, made good money on just because I get bored, like little things. But as far as keeping 700 head of cattle around here and feeding them all every day all winter, I'm not doing that.
Sure. Yeah. Well, that makes sense.
I'm not doing it. No.
Yeah.
Plus, it's not like hay's $30 a bale anymore, and
Yeah.
corn's $3, and interest is 3.5%. If it
Yeah.
was that changes a lot. 8% interest changes a lot of things.
Yeah, absolutely it does. Yeah, it's one of the things that it's funny. In simple terms, if interest goes from 4 to 7%, you think it increases by 4%. Or we'll say 4 to 8% for simplicity. I mean, it sounds like it goes up by 4%, but it went up by 100% in terms of your actual
Yes, it did.
cost of operation. I mean, essentially, the interest is an input, it's your cost of capital. And it's a very in significant increase, a 4% increase in interest rates. And for folks operating very large, intensive, capital intensive businesses on operating notes, that stresses me out.
Stocker cattle really get like a bad. I remember whenever I first got into it, like everyone just looks at you like, "Oh, you're gonna go broke. Don't do that. Oh, that's so risky." And I mean, I'm just a firm believer, like on stocker cattle, if you just use, you got to protect yourself a little bit. I do buy the LRP. You just use your brain and low overhead,
Yeah.
and it's. I'm just gonna say it's been good to me.
Oh, that's
It's,
fair.
you know, absolutely, you know, people, you know, when I first got, started farming, everyone always says, "Well, those cows, you can just always depend on a paycheck every year." Well, a lot of those people, you can depend on spending a lot of money too.
Yes, 100%. Oh my goodness. Yeah.
That's like the old saying, "Oh, if those cows, you just always know you're going to have a check every year." But like the stocker cattle, I don't know, I've just really always got along with them
Yeah.
well. And it, you've got to kind of be, they do get sick, and you've got to kind of be Johnny on the spot on treating them and everything like that. But
Yeah.
and I feel like, I figured you would ask me if I do sell by marketing. I don't. And I'm not against it or anything like that. I mean, There is kind of a point where I see some, I kind of see where that makes sense, you know, like, you know, for instance, a 500-pound heifer worth 240 and a 600-pound heifer worth 218, you know, I know what the better buy is. Yes. But, you know, when you sell a lot of yearlings, you can put a premium on your, I guess, your reputation. You know what I mean? Like, if someone buys cattle from me, they know what they're going to get cattle that's not going to get sick. They're bulletproof. They've had all their shots. They're going to perform. They weren't just put together, you know, a month before.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, when you do it long enough, that kind of puts a premium on what you're selling. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So that's a good point. Have you somehow capitalized on that? I mean, how are you marketing the cattle direct to individuals who know what they're getting? Or
yes, lately I have. Now I've sold at, you know, I've sold at some barns before, and I have nothing against sale barns. I love sale barns, but I have just lately, I basically what I guess you'd call a broker, a guy that knows me very well, knows my cattle, and knows who would like them, and will call, and or I'll call him, we'll look at him, and he'll just start making phone calls. And like last year, you know, I had to start selling early last year because of the drought, and had a guy bought, I think it was two or three loads there pretty early of my cattle, got them in, loved them, wanted more. Mm-hmm. Well, when you got people wanting your cattle, like I said, you can put it, there's a little bit of a premium on them, you know, and what's not to like about them, you know, they're not fat, they're green, they got a lot of go, they're coming off grass, you know, like I said, they're trouble free. And when you can kind of get a reputation like that, you can, you know, you can, it's not hard, they're not hard to sell.
Yeah.
That's how I market them.
I was going to say, even if all you do is sell them direct to somebody and you save the commissions and the trucking, you're ahead.
And the commissions have got, you know, the sale barn guys are going to hate me saying this, but commissions have just got so high. I mean, you know, I don't know what, you know, 2-2.5% is pretty common. When you're selling a yearling for $1,100 and when you're selling one for $1,800, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, not to mention, you know, the shrink, and we do pencil shrink them off the farm, but not like they would at a sale barn. And like, you know, you take the trucking and the commission, everything like that, and you know, you're selling cattle, and here I am going out, you know, here I am borrowing all the money, paying all the interest, treating all the sick ones, getting up at daylight every day to do what I do. Then I'm paying you $50 a head to sell them.
Yeah.
Which, don't get me wrong, that is their business. And that is, there's a time and a place for that. And there are times they'll say, and I'll agree 100%, there's times at a sale barn that you gain that $50 because two, a farmer and a feedlot got into it and they just, you know, and they were higher than heck. And that's fine. That's, you know, but I just really like selling them off the farm. You know, I can load them when I want to. It's everything's dependent upon me, you know.
Makes sense. Kind of shifting gears a little bit away from the livestock, back to the land conversation. You talked about having bought another farm.
Mm-hmm.
You bought the farm you bought at the start. Just kind of curious your perspective, what things you might have to say about the idea of land ownership. You started buying land. Well, I guess you started with the 80 acres of rent, but you didn't really have much of an enterprise built before you jumped into owning a pretty good chunk of land. And you were in a different scenario economy-wise than today for land. But looking at today's market with your experience, what do you have to say about land ownership?
Don't get discouraged. It's harder than it was, that's for sure. I think you're going to see some opportunities in the future to buy some land, and I'll tell you why I think that. Back to the other, we did buy a second farm 2 years ago. There was a farm that had been in CRP for 40 years. That's a mile and a quarter down the road from our house. It came up for sale, and I bought it. I've been waiting my 20 for it, but like I said, a mile from my house. I had the equity in my farm, and I was able to do that. It seems crazy to pay what we paid for it, but when you take that farm and average it with the farm that I own here, it does not seem crazy at all. The And I was, you know, very fortunate, went in, it was a mess. Like I said, it hadn't been touched for 40 years, you know, put our water line in and everything like that. And here is where I see the opportunity to buy land. And my, I can only speak to my area. There is a lot of this ground that's being farmed that shouldn't be farmed. And that's all fine and dandy when corn's $6 and beans are $14 or 50, whatever. Mm-hmm. And all, but there's going to come a day when that's not going to happen. And these poor farms that these investors or whoever's bought, that they're getting $180, $200 an acre rent, there's going to come a day. People aren't, I mean, it's not going to be feasible for that. So right. And now that there's, you know, now that interest, I think interest will come down, I feel like. And I feel like there's going to be some of this ground that's going to get sold to put investments in other places. That's the type of ground a guy's going to have to buy. And it's going to be a challenge. It's going to be a lot of work because you're going to have to fix what someone else has done for the last 10 years. And I'm like, again, I'm not saying that I'm an expert by any means. If you manage properly and kind of do what we talked about, you know, the stacking enterprises, like you're going to have to do stuff like that mm-hmm. to make it justify itself. You know, you're not going to go pay $4,500 an acre for pasture and pay for it. You know, you're going to have to stack enterprises on that land. You're going to have, I mean, you might have to even consider like hunting leases, anything that you can. That's my perspective on the future, on buying land. If you start from nothing, you just, and your mindset has to be different than everyone else's too. I mean, anything you can get now, a small parcel, anything that you can stick a few calves in and just buy a 5 gallon bucket, don't go buy a John Deere tractor, you know, just little thing, make some little money. And you're not going to save enough, you know, to pay cash for anything. And you know, people in the regenerative side seem to be obsessed with having no debt, and that's fine. But land isn't a bad debt; it's a long term debt. You know, it's something that is it should be structured to where you can manage over a long period of time.
Yeah,
don't get carried away with short term debt at all.
Yeah,
but you're gonna kind of have to think outside the box a little bit, and just what this all boils down to is it. 2-a-day moves, 3-a-day moves, isn't, you know, South Pole genetic. What it all boils down to is good management, proper management in every aspect of it. And you're just going to have to be pretty sharp on that. But yeah, this land's way too high. And I got lucky. I mean, you know, I'm not going to, you know, people aren't going to listen to this and say, oh, wow. I never thought about how I could go buy all this ground by doing that because, you know, I got lucky and it was a time frame right before everything got high and I was in the right place at the right time and made some good decisions and got it and then made really bad decisions for, you know, several years.
Yeah.
And still held on to it, you know, and I shouldn't say really bad decisions, but if I could go back to 2011 and do then what I'm doing now, it would be incredible. Mm-hmm. I would have never sprayed any Roundup on this farm, never planted and started, you know, grazing and stacking enterprises on this ground. Oh my gosh, it'd be incredible, you know. Man.
Because it was all grass when you got it, right?
It's all grass. It's a beautiful 400 acre grass farm. And like I said, you know, I listened to everybody and everyone said, oh, you got to farm it. You know, beans are $10. You have to farm it. Yeah. And at the time, you know, calves were, you know, your best calves might bring $750, you know.
Yeah.
But times have changed, you know. I think I bought the guy's hay, you know, whenever I bought the farm, I think I bought his hay for $25 a bale, you know. It was mm-hmm. you know, it was different, but you know, I just fell into that trap a lot of people fall into where I bought a farm, well now I've got to go buy 4 tractors and, you know, all the cool stuff. And that's okay if I don't make it. No, it's okay if, you know, it's not making me money because I'm not going to make any money till I'm 65 years old. Like I said earlier, I just got to a point where I was like, no, I'm not going to live like that. I'm going to make money now. You know, now it's, and I've been fortunate, you know, my wife has a really good job. She's a nurse practitioner. You know, we have 2 little boys. You know, It's not like my, and people give me crap about it. And, you know, like, well, my wife doesn't make the land payment. Trust me. The farm pays for the farm. You know, she helps out with, you know, the kids and, you know, all of our, you know, groceries and everything like that. And we have a system and we work together on it. And, but she's, you know, we're both pretty independent. You know, we handle our finances kind of independently, and she doesn't mind me doing what I'm doing as long as I'm holding up my end of the deal, which is, you know, and a mortgage and, you know, that, you know, my share of the bills, and she does hers, and it works great. So,
mm-hmm. No, that makes sense. And I mean, today to get land to pay for itself is pretty challenging, but if you can even get it to break even, looking at your net worth increases year over year, just with the principal pay down, I mean, can be oftentimes probably what a person's salary is. So if, I mean, it can be a good investment still, not to mention the inflation or increase in value. But I know I'm looking at hoping to in the next year or two have the opportunity to buy a particular farm. And I don't see how, like, if I wanted to go the more conventional model, it's got some barns on it. It's got some tillable ground. It's got some pasture. And the idea of buying the equipment to crop farm on that and buying the equipment to feed cattle in the barns in there and buying the cattle to stock the pastures all at the same time as buying this land piece, it just, I will not do that. That's not in my reality, I guess. Maybe for some people, I mean, that's what you did and you made it work, but that stresses me out. I don't, but it, just the land alone, I can handle that. And
I mean, yes, I did make it work, but I'm going to go back to that luck thing. You know, I did sell a lot of my machinery. And again, during COVID, I sold it for everything that I paid for. You know, people talk about, oh yeah, machinery just depreciates. And typically it does, but it just, it happened to just, it was the right time. You know, I sold a lot of my stuff for exactly what I'd already paid for it. And maybe I could have got more for it in some instances, you know, it's just crazy.
It worked really well for you too, because you were getting out of the business. For a lot of people who are in the same scenario, who bought something in 2010, sold it in 2020 for the same price they bought it for, but they have to replace it with something else. Well, the cost of replacement in the last 3-4 years has gone through the roof too. So you were switching business models to a point where you didn't have to replace your equipment. So you didn't have to feel the pain of inflation on the other end as well. And the cost of new or cost of replacement. So that was a good position to be in. And hopefully that equity works better for you now in your current model than it did sitting in paint and iron.
Well, and you know, I also can't stress, you know, a good bank too earlier, like I did, because even my banker and she's, you know, I have two bankers you know, they even said they were kind of concerned with me doing this, because, like, you know, Drew, you've sold, you know, for instance, if, you know, a few years ago we had the feedlot, you know, I sold 3,000 head of cattle, you know, in 1 year. I said, you know, we just, you know, you're bringing that money in all the time, and now you're going to get to where you're literally selling once a year. You know, you're putting all your eggs in that basket. And I said, I understand that fear, like I understand that, but this is such a better managed enterprise now that I'm not even worried about it.
It's a totally different cost structure. I mean, to compare the two, I mean, yeah, you can say you had a lot more turnover there and a lot more cash flowing through the business, but your overheads, your inputs was a totally different model. I mean, it just, to compare them, it's really two totally, it's apples and oranges.
And quality of life is a lot too. You know, I think some people talk about quality of life and other people might not, you know, think as much about it as others, but I can't tell you how much better my quality of life is since, you know, we started seeding the entire farm down and going all grass and, you know, seasonally doing cattle. And it's so much better. It's just, you know, the other way is just, there was just always something, you know, 365 days a year, whether it's 15 below zero or 105 degrees outside, you know, you know, it's just, you've got to feed cattle. There's always fenced. I mean, and this way, and don't get me wrong, I have something to do every day, but my quality of life is so much better. I feel better. I look at things differently. You know, I've, I guess you'd say a more, you know, holistic view of not only my farm, but, you know, everything. And it's just changed me completely.
Yeah. Love that. Awesome. Well, is there anything else, kind of high level thoughts that I haven't asked you about that you want to share before we wrap up?
Oh, not really. Like I said, I would read, if anyone wants to get into cattle or stock or cattle, I would read Gordon Hazard's book. Like I said, keep in mind
advice from an old cattleman. That's the book, right?
Yeah. Yes. Keep in mind that he wrote that from a perspective of someone from a different generation.
Yeah.
But 95% of what he says rings true today, you know. You also have to keep in mind, like, Gordon Hazard, he was from West Point, Mississippi. That was also like the hay capital of the world. Someone said, told me that. And so it's like, you know, that's all they did down there was put up hay, and he ran soccer cattle so he could buy all the hay, you know. So I mean, you just have to keep some of that stuff in mind. But his principles are, yeah, I like I said, that book, I would buy that book if you don't have it. The other thing, you know, it's like I said, I'm no expert on any of this. I just know what's kind of worked for me, and stacking the sheep and the soccer enterprises has been great for me. As far as research goes on stocker cattle, I'm very disappointed with what's out there. That's why I kind of reached out to you originally, because, you know, when I first started this kind of transition, you know, here I am trying to research, you know, intensive grazing, rotational grazing, whatever you want to call it, stocker cattle, and it's all cow calf.
Yeah.
And even the podcasts you listen to, most of them are cow calf. And you start having a couple guys on that did stockers, and I was like, finally, someone is, you know, having some, you know, something that, you know, because I think every time you listen to a podcast or watch a YouTube video, hopefully my goal is to take one thing away from it, you know, something.
Yeah.
And there just isn't a lot out there for stocker cattle. I mean, it's about all cow calf. And I mean, you know, you can make it relative, you know, but there just isn't a lot of information out there. So that's why I said, read that book, just kind of dig a little bit. And that would be my takeaway from everything.
Awesome. Well, I'm going to put thoughts and advice down from an old cattleman on my resource list as one of your top ones. But are there any other resources that you'd recommend that are important to you?
I read Greg Judy's book. One of them is pretty good. One of his early ones that he wrote. I'm sorry if I don't.
No Risk Ranching.
Yeah, it's the one where he talks about basically why he started doing what he was doing. I think it is No Risk Ranching, and his neighbors made fun of him and everything like that. That's a good book too. Yeah. That's a good one. I bought a Jim Gerrish book. I bought a guy that you had on a while back, the guy in Canada. The Grazing the Sweet Spot.
Yeah. Tom Kravitz. Yeah.
And I read that
Ranching
book.
Like a 12-year-old.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. Now, I don't graze the sweet spot. Like I said, you know, I wait till May to turn out. We have a little bit different grazing strategy, but still, like, there's a lot to take out of there and listen to. And obviously there's YouTube and everything like that. The University of Kentucky's actually put some videos on YouTube about stocker cattle, some pretty good ones on grazing stocker cattle. And yeah, so I've checked those out quite a bit. So
cool. Awesome. Awesome. Last question for you then is, how can people reach out or find out more about you if they want to learn more?
Well, I don't know. I don't have social media. I don't have Facebook. I don't have TikTok. I used to have TikTok, but I got rid of it because I was sick of every time I had 10 free seconds thinking I needed to swipe on my phone. So I said, I'm going to eliminate that from my life.
Good call.
I tell you what, I guess if anyone really wants to get a hold of me, and I don't know why you would, because I am no genius by any means, but I'd definitely give some advice, or if someone wanted to, you know, source some cattle, you know, I live in cattle country. I could, you know, source some dark cattle for somebody, maybe get a hold of you, and then you can get them in touch with me or something.
You bet. Yeah, that sounds good. As long as you're okay with it. People ask me every now and then, and I'm always like, whatever they share on here is what I give out. I don't want to give out a number if somebody hasn't given it out on the podcast. So if you give me permission, I'll share it with
I
people.
reached out to a guy you had on a while back with Connor.
Lyle Cant, yep, from
Yeah,
Wisconsin.
because he was doing, stalker cattle, and
Yep.
I Googled him, and it came to his Facebook, and I just had his number, and I called him and picked his brain on, kind of what he's doing and what I'm doing. And that was, I think that's important at times too for people to compare notes and everything like that, because a
Agreed.
lot of these podcasts, I have a bad deal with, I'll listen to a podcast and I'll leave with more questions than I had answers, because I'm like, man, I wish I could have asked this, or I wish I could have asked, because I'm a stalker guy. I'm worried, I'm worried, are you feeding mineral? Are you implanting? Are you supplementing? What are you supplementing? How many times a day? And that just doesn't get covered a lot, which is fine. And same as the hair sheep, how do you treat your orphan lambs? How often, and that stuff just doesn't get talked about a lot. So I think it is good for people to compare notes and pick each other's brain on that stuff. So.
I'm just putting on my list of possible guests here to do a kind of a panel discussion with like you, Connor, Lau Kant, Chase Jones, and Jordan Meyer are people I've all had on the podcast before who have all done in this kind of a region, this Midwest region, stalkers and backgrounding that or stalker cattle. That would be a cool conversation to have because I think there's a lot of people in this region interested in it. And I think it's a really good model for especially the upper Midwest where winters get really expensive with cow calf. So
Absolutely.
might have to
I
do something
wish
with
there was kind
you
of
all again.
a, if anyone's tech savvy, which I'm not, if I think a really good resource would be like a message board of some type, like a grazing type message. I get on Ag Talk every now and then, and Ag Talk will have, crop talk, machinery talk, stuff like that. And just there's different, threads that you can, click on. And, like a grazing one with, sheep, and then stalkers and cow calf, and maybe another one of, how do I market my, pasture raised, poultry or whatever. I think that'd be a nice resource if
I think you're
someone
right.
other than me would start it.
No, that's a great idea. Yeah, kind of like the bigger pockets for real estate of grazing-based agriculture. I love that idea. Somebody will have to do
Yeah,
it.
maybe you.
Yeah, well, I don't know about that. I'm probably less techie than you are, but my older brother is a software engineer. He's a computer whiz, so he stole it all from us. But well, either way, fantastic conversation. Thanks so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. There's a lot of value. I love what you've done. It's an awesome story that I think is going to inspire a lot of people. The cool thing is what you've done is not like, I mean, you hear first generation ranchers starting in the 80s or 90s or something, you know, I mean, it was a different world then. And even in the 15 years ago or whatever, when you started, it was maybe a little different, a little less expensive land base, but still it's a relatively recent story of awesome success. So congratulations and thank you for joining me.
Very much. No, I'm and thanks for putting on a podcast that people can learn from, and that's why I always like going, I told you, in that, one of our emails, I like yours because you have real world people in real world, kind of scenarios, and that's how you're going to learn, that's how someone's going to pick up information, someone who's like you, who's, and that's what we got to do. So
Awesome. Well, thank you.
yeah, thanks a lot, man.
The Herd Quitter podcast is brought to you by Faro Cattle Company, whose mission is to help ranchers put more fun and profit into their business. You can get more information on Faro Cattle Company at farocattle.com. And if you enjoy what you've heard on this podcast, be sure to subscribe and check us out on Facebook and Instagram at Herd Quitter Podcast or at herdquitterpodcast.com.